helps to turn them on, doesn't it? It is 11 a.m. on September the 14th, 2017. I am interviewing I'm Peter McPherson. I'm interviewing Kathy Patterson, the District of Columbia auditor, in her offices at 717 14th Street Northwest. Okay. Good morning. It's very nice to see you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Yeah. Okay. So, during your time in this job as DC auditor, you have spent a lot of time chewing on the issue of how our public education sector is spending the public's dime.
Right.
Be it modernization or, you know, school operations, food. And I guess the one overarching question that I have, and I think a lot of people do, is what takeaway do you have? Is the public's dime being spent judiciously?
I think one of the big takeaways for me is that the District of Columbia is very healthy financially. There is no sense among policymakers that money comes from anywhere other than trees. we seem to be very free with our spending. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is such a stark contrast with the first few years that I served on the DC Council, mm-hmm. when we were close to bankruptcy under a financial control board and so forth. So the biggest takeaway is a sense that that we have money to spend. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when you have less money to spend, you are a little bit more judicious. Mm-hmm. There is more accountability. There is more reason for accountability. So the city's own success, I think, is one of the reasons why we have seen what I would consider to be fairly significant overspending on our school modernization program.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you and I have chatted offline about, you know, certainly one of my favorite hobby horses, which is the modernization of the Ellington School of the Arts in Georgetown. You know, and I, my sense of it, I just, you know, from sidelines, but somebody who's interested in it, is that, you know, I have never seen quite such an example of municipal profligacy before. I mean, the spending is just, it's almost beyond comprehension.
It is a huge amount of money. And again, once you stipulate that it is going to be a beautiful school, and once you stipulate that having a high-quality performing arts school is a priority in the District of Columbia, sort of grant those two things, then I think it is an extraordinary amount of money. The total authorized spending on that is $178 million. That started out with an estimate of $71 million. And one of the unfortunate things is we seem to have become accustomed to not taking our own numbers seriously. I think it was even the mayor who said recently that, you know, well, let them talk about the money, let the DC auditor or other people talk about the money. But I think it's really important that we make sure that when a budget goes from the mayor's office to the council for consideration, that the numbers are numbers that we can believe in and that mean something. That has not been the case in the school modernization program.
Well, one of the things that I've been struck by is that, I mean, you've seen probably three mayors now who almost, well, and it's been particularly acute with the past two, where everybody says, their people say, well, these figures that we put in the budget are just placeholders.
Right.
You know.
Right.
To which my attitude is, okay, why say $78 million? Why don't you just say $1 and we'll move on from there? I mean, you know, the fact is that relative to what they were intending at Ellington, $78 million wasn't going to be enough, and
right.
and everybody
right.
knew it. And it strikes me that that there's almost a deliberate effort to sort of drop a fog over the whole process, that people know things are going to cost dramatically more than they're saying, and, you know, they lowball numbers, and the result is that we end up paying considerably more down the line. I mean, do you think it's as conspiratorial is kind of a loaded word.
I don't think it's conspiracy.
Yeah, but that it's almost a deliberate kind of obfuscation of of, you know, what things are really going to require?
I think it's a failure to demand that that first number that be that is submitted to the council be a real number. Mm-hmm. And again, as an office of auditors, we're required to look at what the law says and mm-hmm. what the regulations say. And our law is really pretty clear that when there is a capital improvement program submitted by the mayor to the council, particularly for the school modernization program, it's supposed to have a lot of very specific pieces of information in it. And the contracts for working on these schools are required to have a lot of very specific pieces of information in it, in them. And one of the things that our audit reports have found is that not only that no one believes them, but they're just not even consistent with the law. So it, I think, behooves the council to make sure that the executive branch of the D.C. government, including the office of the CFO, is obeying the law. And if a CIP, a capital improvements program, comes to the council that no one has any faith in, then the council should reject it. So I think there is a lot of blame is the right word. There's a lot of responsibility here that is shared across the government. But I think a major factor is that we have had the money to spend, and there's not really a downside, except when you consider that there are a lot of schools that have not yet been modernized. And then the other downside, from my perspective, looking at the numbers, is looking at the district's operating budget. And if you look today at the operating budget for the fiscal year that starts October 1, and you look line by line at what we're spending our money on, and you sort of look from the most expensive to the least expensive agencies in the district government, those budget lines are as follows. I believe the Healthcare Finance Agency is the number one, because that's where our Medicaid program is. That's where a lot of healthcare dollars are. Yeah. The next two items are DC Public Schools and DC Public Charter Schools. If we counted them together, they would top the health line. Then that fourth line in our budget is debt service. $700 million is paid out in debt service, repaying the borrowed money that we have borrowed to build these schools and rec centers and other facilities, but primarily DC Public Schools and the School Modernization Program is a big chunk of that. If you're a budget person, if you're an appropriator, and you're trying to respond to needs of the community, wouldn't it be nice to have that $700 million figure be less? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to take $200 out of that to spend it on housing or to spend it on something else that's a high priority? But you can't, because we have borrowed money to build these incredibly expensive buildings, and now we're paying it back, and those dollars are not available for other priorities.
Yeah. For me, one of the things that I'm struck by is you look at the costs, particularly the high schools, all right, of what it's cost to redo these high schools or fundamentally, you know, build anew. And, you know, you look at comparable construction within our own region, you know, and our costs are dramatically higher. I mean, sometimes it strikes me as up to a third more for a comparable structure. I mean, what I would cite in as an example is, you look at Ballou High School. The same architect designed Ballou High School as did Wakefield High School in Arlington, and designed to serve a comparable number of students, were built in a similar manner in that, you know, they took one part of the site and built a new building and, you know, and then tore down the other. But, you know, the Ballou project ended up being $45 million more. You know, and so, I mean, I'm just curious, what do you think accounts for that?
One of the things I've had mentioned is a lack of discipline. It's a lack of any countervailing force to keep costs down. For example, we don't do any bidding as to price. We don't say, okay, Ballou is going to be $100 million. Or no, we don't say Ballou is going to be built. It's going to have these specifications. Here's what we want. Here's what the community wants. construction firms A, B, and C, tell us what you can build it for to those specifications. We do not do construction bids.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of the cost driver. I think one of the things we recounted in our report on Ellington is some of the history behind the purpose for competitive bidding in federal contracts, in other state and local contracts, because that is one way to have some discipline at what the cost will be.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you another cost driver is the fact that the community today takes great pride in these high schools, and we have the greenest high school in the country. We have Ellington, possibly the fanciest artistically in the country. And people do take great pride in that. One of the things that we did in the first modernization report after I took this job, which is about 2 years ago now, we looked at some other audit reports from around the country, and we found an audit report on schools in Texas, and
mm-hmm.
I don't remember the actual numbers, but one of the things they did that was captured in this audit report was they came up with a model for an elementary school, and then they built that same school 3, 4, 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
Same architecture, same design, same materials, and you get huge economies of scale. Well, I'm pretty cheap. I'm pretty prudent. If I were in charge of school modernization, maybe I would have said, okay, let's come up with a DC public school high school design and then build that same cookie-cutter high school 4, 5, 6, 7 places around the district. I don't think the community would have liked that. I think there's great pride in our individual high schools. So I think that may not be a major cost driver, but I think that is one, and that's one that a lot of folks in the public,
yeah.
I think, would defend.
Well, I guess, for me, I look at what they did at Wakefield High School in Arlington, and I mean that school was architecturally, completely different than the one that it replaced, but also architecturally different. I mean, Arlington on a smaller scale to
mm-hmm.
DC, has been on a bit of a construction jag too, but all of their schools look different, and it's still
it's still conservative.
And so I guess one of the questions I have is. Or one of the theories I have, and I'd be interested in hearing what you're saying, is that, we had that that partnership, the
DC Pep.
The Pep Boys, as they refer to. And that, these guys are contractors, that we basically had contracted out the entire modernization program.
Right.
And that, the project managers have been lavishly compensated. I mean, I was really struck by that, more than $200,000 a year for
well,
the project managers.
The last annual budget, I think, was something like $9 million, and like per the contract, that was to pay the salaries of 30 employees. So you do the math.
Yeah. It's just staggering. And, do you think that... not only the costs associated in hiring people outside of the government and the level of compensation, but also the fact that these folks fundamentally, I don't think, are governed by, fidelity to, saving the taxpayers money, but more, here's the deadline, here's what they want, and here's when it has to be finished by.
Right, and to be fair to the professionals at that organization, they have delivered what they set out to deliver. They've delivered some pretty fabulous schools. This is the program management firm that you're referring to. But by the same token, we, the district government, essentially handed off our responsibility to them. We found in a couple of the audits that we did 2 years ago and the Ellington one last year,
mm-hmm.
they essentially were standing in the shoes of the government. Even when we needed to get financial records on some of the purchases or some of the contract documentation, we had to go to the program manager, the private sector program manager, because the Department of General Services didn't have the information. So we really did hand off the government's responsibility to a private contractor. So not only do they not necessarily have the strictures of a taxpayer-funded budget in mind, but they also were, frankly, doing the government's work. And we had a school system and leadership that basically said, facilities, that isn't our core mission. We're happy to have somebody else take it over. Here, you take it over.
Yeah. Well, and that has been a popular refrain with mayors and with the three leaders of DCPS that we've had since the Reform Act, and Kaya Henderson famously would talk about, well, that's not a core competency.
Right.
And I think she probably deeply regretted ever using that term, you know, because it's became sort of like an anvil around her neck. But you know, I guess the thing is, every place, you look at the other school systems, most school systems, you know, food service is part of their portfolio.
Right.
The buildings are part of the
portfolio. Right. I mean, what our chancellor position is at this point in time is a chief academic officer, and that is critically important. But it's a different job than the CEOs, the chief executive officers, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when they had all of the school construction and the facilities issues in their portfolio, and they had, as you know, food services in their portfolio. It's a different job. It's just a very different set of responsibilities.
Yeah, but it strikes me that you could make an argument that farming out these pieces, you know, like transportation, actually what falls under the Office of the State Superintendent for Education, and, you know, the food, you know, Sodexo is a big company, has the contract, and then, you know, farming out modernization to these. I mean, it's just, I guess, you look at DCPS with a budget of around $1 billion a year for fewer than 50,000 students, and, you know, you look at some of our surrounding jurisdictions, like Loudoun County in Virginia or Anne Arundel County in Maryland, where we have a situation where they have twice as many students and they're doing it for the same money that DCPS gets.
Right, right. You mentioned food services. We did a report on that subject last fall. I'm looking at the big decision made some years back to contract out all of our school food services, and basically came up with a recommendation that the District of Columbia consider insourcing, bringing that back inside and bringing it back in-house, not just to be able to have better controls over the quality, but frankly to really save some money and be able to reallocate that additional money to elsewhere, to other high priorities.
Well, there are other school systems that, I mean, in our region, it's a profit sector for them. I mean, they actually make money on it. They don't lose money. That it's either neutral or they make money because they're doing it internally.
Right, and they get reimbursed by the federal government, and they manage to do the whole program on the federal reimbursement. Whereas we get the federal reimbursement, but we also put a whole lot of district dollars into the program. I was on another radio show sometime back with a woman who had run our food services some years back, and she's now running the program in Detroit. And talked about what they've done there and how entrepreneurial they are and how closely they work with the community, because they do it from inside the school system. We also profiled school systems that had contracted out to the Chartwells and the Sodexos and brought it back in-house, and how much better they found the services, the food, the utilization, and as well as the financials.
Yeah. I guess, you know, it comes down to a thing of the public's voice. I mean, you know, lots of people testify every year at every hearing, the Council Education Committee or the committee responsible for the Department of General Services has on issues related to the school. They're always very well attended, lots of people sign up, and I'm always struck by how little it really seems to move the needle, you know, that an awful lot of stuff is done that doesn't seem to represent, I mean, what seems like kind of a broad public consensus on things. And I guess, you know, from your take, I mean, in your current job, but also having been, and I use this in a loving way, not in a negative way, as a former politician.
I embrace that.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, it's not a dirty word, at least not for me. And, you know, why do you think if you accept my premise, the public's voice doesn't really seem to register in the way, at least for me, that it should? And do you have any ideas about mechanisms that could be employed to, you know, change that dynamic?
Well, a couple of things. One sort of broad point. when the mayoral takeover legislation was enacted in 2007, mm-hmm. it did away with the elected Board of Education. That was the first sort of line of defense, if you will, the first place for residents, for parents, for everyone to go to on education and education policy. With that change, I think the assumption that I made and that probably a lot of other people made was that the council, in approving that major change, would take on the role of the Board of Education as a policy partner with the mayor in terms of what happens in DC public schools. I'm not sure that sense on the part of the council is really embraced by everyone. I mean, to be sure, we have had education chairs, Councilmember Catania, now Councilmember Grasso, who do take the work very seriously and who seek to bring about reforms in the school system and seek to address some of the serious issues like the achievement gap. But council members have a huge job. They are city councilmen, county commissioners, state legislators. They have a huge range of issues that they're responsible for. To be responsible in addition for all of the work that the Board of Education did as a voice for the residents, I'm not sure how feasible that is for 13 people. So that, I mean, that's one issue is in terms of who is the voice. I think, and I forgot what my second point was, so please
all right,
go ahead.
It's all right. Another piece of it, though, is that, you know, because of the council's committee structure, I mean, you know, even though all of the committees have multiple members, I mean, essentially they become committees of one, at least from where I sit, you know. And that, you know, education oversight in the District of Columbia, at least by the council, I mean, relative to DCPS, is done by David Grasso. And, I mean, David Grasso works very hard.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, I mean, and this is just my perception, but I feel like at the end of the day, he gives those education agencies the benefit of the doubt almost every time. You know, that that there are times that he could and should demand more and doesn't. I mean, you know, the public will come to him, but, you know, it doesn't really seem to yield a change. And so I wonder if that is tied up again in the fact that, you know, is that education oversight is basically done by a committee of one.
I think that the reason that you will see at a hearing sometimes the chair of the committee is the only person at the hearing, I think speaks to what I was just saying, that the council has such a broad, huge mandate. Each committee chair has a huge portfolio of issues, and so I think all but one or two of the council members has a committee to chair right now, and they all have this very broad mandate. So it's not surprising that other council members aren't there, and that so Councilmember Grasso, as you say, becomes an overseer of one. But I think that's part of the structure, and that's part of how the council works, because, as I say, they are, I mean, it is a city, a county, and a state function. The other point that I don't have remembered that I was going to make in terms of the resident of the district voice, one of the things that we tried to do in the school modernization legislation in 2005-2006 when I was the education committee chair was to build in what seemed at the time to be best practices around the country on modernization. And one of the elements of the legislation was to create a citizen advisory committee for the school modernization program. And that was a committee that was, you know, named by the mayor, confirmed by the council. Probably, I haven't gone back to look at the statute, but the idea was to have the community's voice in the decision-making process. That functioned for maybe a year or two. Individuals were named to it. It did exist. It was there.
Kind of died on the vine.
But it died on the vine in part because it got no staff support. Yeah. Now, an amendment in the legislation before it was final said that the chief financial officer's office would provide staff support to this modernization committee. I have no idea if anybody at the CFO shop even knew that. But it essentially died, and then 4 or 5 years later, it was actually deauthorized in an omnibus piece of legislation that got rid of a lot of task forces and commissions. But that, had we had a modernization task force as envisioned by the legislation, and let's say the Ellington decisions were being made, they did look, DCPS and DGS did look at two other potential sites, But there was no community weigh-in. There was no community sense other than neighbors in Georgetown in particular. So had there been the committee that was envisioned, I think there would have been a community voice. There would have been a lot more debate. It would have been certainly more publicly known what the decisions were that were being made along the way. Mm-hmm. So that's just one small example of one way in which a community's voice can be felt. That could be reinstated. That could be recreated legislatively.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is that how it strikes me, and I think that this is just a reflection we see nationally at this particular juncture in the country's history. Of, I think we're very enamored of sort of executive power, that it somehow we think it's going to streamline things, that things will be done more efficiently, but. I mean, from where I sit, where what it's yielded, especially here locally, as it relates to education, is far greater degree of opacity and accountability. And I remember I was struck by in the first report. I believe it was in the first report you did about the schools, the modernization program. Mm-hmm. And this was something that I said in testimony. Before when Vince Gray was chairman of the council, back in 2010, that there is no discernible process in this modernization program. How the schools were chosen, how this was all going to unfold, and I think you reached a similar conclusion. And I wonder what your perception is in terms of the way that this unfolded, what its impact on equity has been in terms of modernization. I mean, my bias would be, or my perception would be, that there are communities that have gotten kind of the short shrift because of this, that have been waiting a long time and they're going to be waiting even longer.
Well, I think the time that it has taken to get to all of the schools is certainly a factor, and it has been impacted greatly by the amounts that we have spent to date, because a dollar will only, even $178 million will only go so far. But I think we're seeing the final high school is being renovated now. So in terms of high schools, I think we're going to be Coolidge. I think we're going to be sort of hitting 100% in terms of modernizing the high schools. And in terms of a process, let me come back to Councilmember Grasso, the chair of the Education Committee. One of the things we did flag, as you note in the 2015 report, was lack of process. But he did put through legislation that put some criteria around how schools would be selected, how they would find their way onto the capital improvement program. And it's my recollection that either DCPS or the mayor's office is to make public what that list looks like based on all those criteria under this piece of legislation. So, I mean, I'm pleased that issue that has been flagged has been addressed. We'll have to see how successfully it has been addressed, but it's certainly out there as legislation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think David Grasso himself has complained about, a lack of fidelity on the part of the mayor and DCPS and DGS toward that legislation, or even funding its implementation, within the budget. And, and it strikes me this is another complaint I hear a lot out in the community is, that we have a lot of laws governing how, education is supposed to be conducted. I mean, how the agencies are run, the reporting requirements, public participation. And it's like, some would say, well, all these laws are optional.
It does sometimes feel that way. But again, from a council member's standpoint, I think sometimes you have to look, sort of stand back and say, how can I have the most impact to get a good outcome in the situation before me, and is it to work as closely as I can with the new chancellor, with Deputy Mayor Niles, with Mayor Bowser? Is that the best way to try to get things to happen in our schools, or is it, outside the building throwing rocks through the windows? Is it being a vocal critic? And I know I went through this as a council member, and I would say publicly that when Mayor Williams was mayor, he was my partner as what was my line? As part, my partner as often as possible, and I'm a critic as often as necessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, you sort of.
I like that line.
I didn't say it quite right, but yeah. You get the idea. And I think it's true that for a legislator, you have to figure out what's the best way to make something happen, because legislators don't build buildings and legislators don't staff classrooms. They try to enact policy that underlies some of those things. But working, trying to work closely with the executive is certainly one very sound strategy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess this comes down to maybe a culture of the council, but yeah, we have an astounding amount of money in that current account balance, you know, that, what, more than $2.4 billion now? And, you know, that's money that wouldn't have to dig very deep into that to make an impact on a lot of things. And yet, I think that from where I sit, that the council's and the mayor's unwillingness to do that, to use that money, like with this, because of the profligacy in the modernization program, you know, there's lots of schools that got pushed back, money is much tighter, and but that it sort of becomes almost like what is it that Superman has, kryptonite, or it's sort of budgetary kryptonite, where they we've got all this money in the bank and we're not touching it, and like this is evidence of our fiscal probity. And yet, you know, as we've seen with education spending, I mean, you know, there's been an astonishing amount of waste, you know. And so, I mean, do you think that the council, the mayor, that we're collectively talking about these issues honestly? I mean, we're having a candid conversation about how we're spending the money, why we're not using the money in the any of it in the huge surplus, to meet these other unmet needs.
The record will show I was very supportive of having a very sound reserve. And so I would probably, I'm not on the council, I'm not a policymaker, but I would probably opt to not dip into those reserves, because, you know, I cut my teeth politically in the control board era, and when the district was looking for every dime it could find. So my orientation is to try to make do with what we have, but that does speak to trying to get better bang for the buck. In terms of the equity issue that you mentioned and the will we get to all the schools issue, one thing that happened when our first report came out in 2015, I had an opportunity to testify before the council on the committee report and on the findings, and to my surprise, at close to the end of that hearing, Mayor Bowser, walked into the hearing room and actually was, I think, permitted to testify. And this was totally unscheduled, but the point was she wanted to make clear that education and school facilities is a priority. And as a, longtime former and previous lives education advocate, I was really happy to see that. I was happy to hear that. So I think, yes, we're not spending money as wisely as I wish we would, but I do believe that that one of the results of the advocacy done in the 2005-2006, we will finish building all of our schools. I think we will. I think there's that commitment. I think it's been made over and over again. So that's sort of one piece of good news that I take away. I'm just hoping we will get a little bit better at how we're spending the money.
Well, I guess, getting back to sort of that equity piece is that, that you look at a school like Garfield Elementary School over on the other side of the Anacostia. I mean, this is the first school building in the district that was designed by an African-American architect. And but it needs a lot. And, it may be almost a decade before it gets it, And you have some charter schools that are opening up around it, springing up with these brand new buildings. And, and the fact is that taxpayers are paying for those buildings too, And so I guess it becomes the thing is that an equity problem of the fact that the created by this spending, the way that the spending has been conducted, these schools that have been late on the list you know, they've drifted further and further back. And if you happen to be unfortunate enough to go to a school that doesn't have the ability to be a squeaky wheel, I mean, you're in a very bad place.
I mean, I have not, we have not looked at the equity issue. We have not looked at the sort of geographical equity issue. We haven't really looked at those issues. I think what we have been focusing on is really more of the systemic issues in terms of how the modernization program itself works, in the hope that that will help the dollars go considerably farther. And mm-hmm. and one thing that we have seen, I mentioned the legislation that Councilmember Grasso had done that seeks to get at the equity issues. In addition, something that the administration has done that was a recommendation of ours has to do with DCPEP that we mentioned earlier. They're no longer the program managers. There's no longer a contract with them. That partnership, I don't know if it still exists, but it's not a program manager for the district right now. And instead, they let contracts with a series of program management, project management firms, which we had recommended, in the hope that having multiple project managers would be a way of building more oversight of the money, more best practices, and hopefully over time the district would be able to see which of these program managers did a better job, and then maybe, you know, more of the money, more of the work goes to those more efficient, more effective program managers. So I just mention that because there have been some improvements, I think, in terms of the management of the program since we began issuing these reports, and I take hope from that.
Yeah. You know, I realize that, you know, it's not always terribly fashionable to talk about expanding the government, but I mean, you think that there's anything to be said for bringing that capacity back into the government, creating that capacity, like within the Department of General Services, rather than, you know, going out and paying for it on the outside?
Well, you know, when I mentioned that last dollar figure when DCPEP was running the program, it was $9 million for a year, and I'm not asking questions, but I would have loved to have asked the DGS director, well, don't you want to spend that $9 million? Don't you want to have that to, you know, paying your staff to do this work? Absolutely. I think the accountability can be clearer mm-hmm. when district government employees are doing what are substantially public functions.
Mm-hmm.
When you contract out, generally speaking, you sort of make elastic that connection between the policy, the oversight, the accountability. You make it much more tenuous when you're going through a contracting operation. So, sure, I would very much like, I'm not sure I want to bring back the generals.
And like, but, you know, and it's just, it becomes a thing of, I just wonder, you know, if people are actually employees of the city. You know, it's just that they have a more, they have a more direct connection, with the stakeholders.
And you can, if I'm a council member, I can hold the DGS director accountable for what the DGS director's staff does.
Yeah.
It's much less tenuous. It's much more direct.
Yeah. This next question, I guess it's kind of a gut question, okay? But, you know, you, like I mentioned, you know, what some of our surrounding jurisdictions spend, you know, comparable to what DCPS spends for twice the number of students. And I guess I just wonder, with $1 billion, shouldn't we be able to have it all? I mean, you know. Good foreign languages, school libraries, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. I mean, it's just like, even in the United States of America in 2017, $1 billion is still a lot of money.
Right, it absolutely
you
is.
Know?
And one of the things I would like to see with Ellington, and this is a recommendation in our report, it is a fabulous building, and it's going to do, you know, there are wonderful things will happen there as they have in the past with our students going on to wonderful professional careers. But having invested that significant amount of money, maybe we need to do something in addition with that building beyond serving, you know, 600 students in a performing arts high school.
Are you thinking like a Western high school?
Absolutely. Why can't we seek to put a small comprehensive high school in that space? The way the space is utilized, it's, you know, half a day the performing arts space is used, half a day the academic classrooms are used. We should be able to figure out a way to get better value from the money that we have invested there.
Yeah.
And so one of our recommendations is just for the government to try to come up with better ways to utilize that building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and I know that a lot of people spoke about that need. And I mean, one of the things that I find quite interesting is that, I mean, at this juncture, it is almost as if Western High School, I mean, the institution that was Western High School, has completely, you know, vanished from the public memory. I mean, when I wrote something recently about the whole Arlington thing, I was just very struck by what a storied history the school had had. I mean, some of the kids who'd attended it, you know, one of the people who had was part of the Red Orchestra in Germany, she lived out in the Midwest and came to Washington, graduated from Western, and met a German guy and ended up in Germany. And, you know, she was, you know, helped lead, you know, this opposition to Hitler and ended up being executed for it. And there are lots of stories like that. There are lots of stories like that. And I feel like, you know, that the school's previous life is just sort of, you know, is been allowed to fade from the public memory. But, yeah, but again, it's just sort of, what sort of a process, I mean, you want to do that, lots of people would like to see that, especially to relieve overcrowding at Wilson, but it's just like, okay, so, I mean, based on, like, my own experience dealing, testifying before the council about the Arlington Project, you know, if one or two people are just sort of, not going to go there. I mean, that's it. So, I mean, and this to me, again, circles back to the public's voice of, to move the needle now, you have to turn up the volume really loud. And, you know, and that strikes me as a real problem when you're, even on the smallest of issues, you know, it takes an extraordinary amount of effort to move the needle, even on fairly minor matters. You know, and I just you know, wonder, well, you know, the public, most of the money for DCPS comes from the taxpayers. I mean, I know there's federal money in there, but there's a lot of municipal treasure in that budget as well.
Yeah.
You know, and just as a matter of sort of long term kind of public confidence in these institutions, you know, it strikes me that over and I'd be interested to know, you know, what your take on it is, that over time, it seems like it will become increasingly corrosive to the public confidence in them because, you know, that there's just so little direct accountability. I mean, do you think we could keep going on as we have?
I think some of these things sort of ebb and flow. If you go back in time and sort of try to recall, how did we get the school modernization program in the first place? I mean, I'd like to say, because my name is on some committee reports, that it was all my idea. Well, it wasn't.
Yeah.
There was a very strong, persistent community advocacy effort that got the attention of former Mayor Fenty, of other, you know, other politicians, myself included, but...
Yeah.
And that was something that took a number of years. I mean, it wasn't by accident. I mean, we've had 2 years of hearings, but it was folks in the community who would call up the, you know, local TV stations and say, come take a look at this building and the raindrops falling through the roof onto the, you know, desks and so forth. I mean, it really took a concerted effort on the part of the public to really raise this issue up. I'm not sure how you mobilize people on the issue of getting better value for our taxpayer dollars. It's been my experience that that happens when there is a countervailing need for those dollars.
Mm-hmm.
If there were something else that people wanted to spend their money on, then they would come to the council and say, we want this, we want that. And that might, you know, force more closer looks at how we're spending the money we have today. So I'm not sure how you build a voice for for more prudent use of the taxpayer resources.
Yeah.
It's certainly worth doing.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of funny. When the budget was being retooled by the council, you know, to put more money into education, as you know, council member Che stepped in, you know,
right,
took money out of the transportation budget and gave it to education. And some of that money, 30-some million dollars, is going to the modernization of John Eaton Elementary School. You know, and they're jumping over a lot of other schools, moving it up in the list. But, you know, I guess the question is, so is it going to take, you know, Donald Trump's limousine running over a really big pothole because we haven't, we took the money from potholes to get to education, you know, and his limousine, you know, loses an axle or something? Is that the kind of thing that it's going to take?
What, to get more money back for potholes?
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or you know, or like I said, some sense of value, you know, some sense of, I mean, you know, I just feel like there really, to me, wasn't any kind of meaningful discussion about, well, okay, that money comes out of the transportation budget. What does that mean? You know? I mean, I do think of it in terms of a zero-sum game.
The other hand, if you can trust your elected officials, Council Member Che has chaired that committee for quite a while now, so I assume she's become very familiar and well-informed on the Department of Transportation budget, and if she thinks that that part of what is in her committee's purview can do without that funding, I mean, I don't, she certainly
yeah,
knows
I mean,
more
it's
about
a, it's
than
a,
I do.
It's a political judgment,
right,
you know, and I understand that, and, you know, you hope in the course of making political judgments that those political judgments will line up with, you know, what's broadly in the best interest.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, you know, and that's what we have elections for, people to make that determination. But like I said, again, it sort of comes down to the thing of, because of the structure of the council and because of the compressed time frame for dealing with the budget, sometimes there really isn't a lot of fulsome discussion about things, you know. I guess, you know, one thing that we haven't really talked about at all so far is the charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as an auditor, as a district resident, you know, as somebody, you know, who has been, you know, waiting around in this whole budgetary morass, I mean, are we looking, do we have the mechanisms to look adequately at charter school spending? I mean, how the money is being spent, whether there is value there. I mean, do you have the ability to peer into all of that in a way that you can make some meaningful judgments for taxpayers?
I think that's a very good question, and I think it's an open question. Because of the authority that my office has in the charter, I think we have authority to look at whatever we choose to look at, within,
mm-hmm.
including within the charter sector.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a universally held opinion.
Mm-hmm.
This office was completing an audit that looked at some of the charter issues at the Charter School Board,
mm-hmm.
When I first got here, and I think there was a concern that we didn't have the kind of authority with the charters that we have with DCPS because of the private sector
mm-hmm.
operators. So that was a conversation that had already been had when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the public generally, in terms of the council, in terms of transparency, there is a great deal of information available about charters and how they function and how much money they have and so forth and so on, but it is not as transparent as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a policy matter in terms of what information the council chooses to acquire for itself. And I think it's something that is certainly worth looking at from the standpoint of the council, because to not have the full ability to you know, walk behind where every dollar goes that goes
mm-hmm.
to the charter sector, I think that's a fair issue for the council to be looking at.
Yeah. The new contract between the WTU and the city, you know, as part of all of that, $53 million will go to the charters, you know, as part of this formula. So, you know, the teachers got a raise, but then the charters will get $53 million as well.
They would get the funding that's allocated by the funding formula.
Yeah,
what you're referring
to? It's an equity mechanism.
Yeah.
Then I guess do you think at the end of the day that you know, that money that flows, that $53 million that flows to the charter is kind of a windfall, that we would really be able to, public would be able to appreciate, say, in a year or 2 years, how that $53 million was utilized?
You know, I have to just be very honest with you here. I'm not familiar with that figure, and I'm not familiar with the impact and the relationship between the collective bargaining agreement and charter funding. I am familiar with the uniform funding formula and how that's the mechanism the money gets to charters, but I just have not taken a look at the issue that you're raising.
Yeah. Well, I guess, it just sort of comes back into that whole thing. I mean, there, especially among people who advocate for DCPS, who are involved in DCPS, feel like that money is just, it goes out, and that our understanding of how it is spent is not always well understood. But you do feel like the mechanisms are there, or that the information is there, that the public can really clean it? Because, I mean, there's a little bit of a disconnect between what people, who are involved fighting for money for DCPS, is what they say. Well, this money flows to the charters, and we have no idea about how it's really being used. But you feel more confident that it is possible to understand?
It's my understanding that there could be greater transparency and that the law could drive greater transparency. I think one of the changes, I believe, has been made that makes some of the financial information from nonprofits available to the council from the charter schools. And I think there was discussion, but I frankly haven't followed up on that issue, whether the similar information is available from for-profit entities that operate charters. So I just acknowledge that it's an issue that could merit some review, but it's not one that I have really looked at.
When you look at $1 billion for DCPS, what, maybe another $600 million or so for the charters, when you look at that level of spending, in totality for the number of students that we have, is it implicit that would be wasteful, or is it possible to say, no, that this is still good, and in spite of the amount of money that is collectively flowing to public education in DC?
I don't think it's too much money if it's well spent. I mean, I do know that we spend an extraordinary amount of money per student in comparison with, I think only the Department of Defense, maybe their schools were the only ones that had a higher per capita expenditure the last time I looked at those statistics. But I think we have such serious issues here in terms of the achievement gap that spending the additional money, I think we need to make sure that the amount of money we are spending is addressing the issues that present themselves to us.
Yeah.
And that is that we have a very large segment of our student population who need a lot of help to get through school, to get their high school graduation, to go on to post-high school, further training, further education, college, university. We need to be addressing that achievement gap, and I think there is certainly the intention. It's been stated as a priority. If it could be proven that the dollars are getting us there, then no, I don't think it's too much money.
Yeah, but if we look at collectively, when they released the PARC scores a few weeks ago, there was some movement in the DCPS scores. There was virtually none in the charter school scores.
But again, they're in both sectors. It's all over the place.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. It's just that we have been spending lavishly on public education collectively for a long time, and and after a decade of mayoral control, and that has run concurrently with this great experiment in charter schools in the city. I mean, we're kind of almost ground zero for them, I guess, after New Orleans.
Yeah,
it's just like there's still an awful lot of kids using the measures that both the charters and DCPS have chosen. Let's say we have a hell of a long way to go, and I guess, have we reached some sort of Rubicon where we should be saying, is this working? I mean,
I don't think we have the data to answer that question. And in saying that, I go back to a report that this office had an administrative role in helping produce, the report that the National Academy of Sciences, produced on PARA, on the mayoral takeover legislation.
Yeah.
And one of their conclusions, and this was, you know, some very, very strong, very bright education folks, researchers, former superintendents,
yeah.
people who know the field,
yeah.
one of their findings was that there needs to be additional research done. There needs to be additional data generated and shared with scholars. There needs to be perhaps even some kind of a research consortium here in the District of Columbia, as there is in Chicago, to be able to answer those kinds of questions, to be able to say on a fairly regular basis, yes, what we are doing is making progress. One of the things that this school system suffered from for many years
mm-hmm.
was the constant churn, was
mm-hmm.
having 11 superintendents in as many years or whatever the
yeah.
numbers were. And I think we've at least seen some stability. We've at least seen some ability to take those initial very rigorous academic standards that were approved prior to the mayoral takeover
yeah.
and implemented under
yeah.
the Rhee-Henderson regime. So we have seen some consistency and some continuity in the sort of academic program. That has to be a good thing, to have that consistency.
Yeah, intuitively,
but we don't know.
Yeah, intuitively, you would think that would be the case. But it's interesting, we have bought ourselves a lot of stability at the top, and like in central office. But I saw statistics the other day, you know, where we've gone through something like 350, 360 principals in the past decade since the takeover. So, and you know, and then also the churn within the teacher corps as well. And so, you know, it's like, okay, so we've gotten stability in one area, but then, you know, but then it has been, you know, very I don't know, chaotic is kind of a loaded word, but I'm going to stick with it. You know, chaotic in terms of what is happening on the ground in the local schools. And I'm interested, and I agree with your point about sort of the evaluative kind of deficit that we have of actually being able to look at what we've tried and what has worked and what hasn't. And one of the things that strikes me is that there has been this real emphasis on kind of the new thing, whatever the new
right,
thing
right,
is,
right.
you know, and we do it, and either we continue it, which is often not the case, but we never have a way of looking back, of saying, well, okay, here's what we did, what has worked. I mean, we do have some sense of the big things, like the evaluation system, impact, you know, and it's just like from what has been published, and I think even that they touched on that in that National Academy of Sciences report about PARA, that you know, it's ambiguous, you know, it's not clear cut. So, you know, things that we've invested the most lavishly in, I mean, we do know that, you know, some of it has been fairly ambiguous, and then, you know, other things that went on for a briefer period of time, we have not really looked back at you know, kind of retrospectively.
Right, right.
And so, I mean, do you think that like an actual separate entity, something that is separate from the charters and DCPS, you know, that could do that
as
kind
a research
of
work? Consortium?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And there were some local
mm-hmm.
community education advocates who were actually working on an idea
yeah.
along those lines coming out of the PARA report
yeah.
and went to the council members to try to look for some funding. And the reason I'm aware of this is the idea was to have an independent research consortium along the lines of the one in Chicago
yeah.
that could churn out reports and really
yeah.
you know, measure the progress, if any. But it needed to be housed someplace initially, and so one idea was to house it here at the Office of the D.C. Auditor, so that's the reason I had these conversations. But
Well, how did you feel about it living here?
I said absolutely as an incubator. I don't think over time this would be the right place. I think something independent.
But some place
would
to get it started, maybe give it a little bit of insulation.
Something like that. But again, I mention this because I think there continues to be a group of community leaders who really would like to see something like that go forward.
Yeah.
And I think that would probably be a good idea.
So. Yeah, well, and I mean, it does strike me as a very useful form of sunlight, you know.
Right, and I can see, you know, you're asking me questions, but I can sit here and tell you the questions that I would love to have something like that answer. I mean, your question about churn among principals, the issue of churn among teachers, I don't know what impact that has had. I don't know what impact that has had in the District of Columbia Public Schools, but I would love to know. I would love for someone to study
that. Would too, because, you know, in your gut, at least in my gut, maybe you've got a more reliable gut. My wife always says I don't have a reliable gut at all. But in my gut, it's like, you know, it feels like it has to matter. When you go through the personnel that we have in the past decade, it just feels like, you know, it has to matter. It seems like it has to matter. So sorry. My apologies. If I was prescient, I would have turned this damn thing off. But again, it's like there are plenty of things that we want to believe, you know, that, you know, the research can end up telling us, no, it really doesn't matter, you know. And maybe I remember a couple of years ago, you know, Kaya Henderson gave that State of the School speech that she gave every year. And she did one back in 2015 with Jim Vance, Lily Jim Vance. And she said, well, you know, churn in and of itself isn't a bad thing, you know. My first thought when I heard that was, well, yeah, you could say that about chicken pox too, you know. but, you know, it seems like a question that is really worthy of, you know, a sober, detached kind of analysis. I guess, you know, in closing, you know, I've been asking the questions, but, you know, you were a journalist in a previous life, as I was, and what would you speak to, what would you want to ask you about that I haven't asked you about?
What studies do you have upcoming that touch on any of these issues?
Yeah. And I think you have one coming out about elementary school staffing.
Yes,
right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We do. We decided to take a look at the comprehensive staffing model that was implemented several years ago as a way, frankly, to try to make sure that there is continuity in schools across the District of Columbia so you don't have academic program A here and academic program Z over there. Mm-hmm. So the way we're looking at this is we picked 8 elementary schools, a sort of random sample of 8 elementary schools, one in each ward, to see how they have managed the comprehensive staffing model. And I think it will be a very useful report, particularly for the local school communities, because we really go into some detail about how the budget process works from the local school advisory team perspective, and what things in these 8 schools were proposed to change the original budget mark, and what things were accepted, most of their proposals were. I think it's going to be a really good look.
Do you have any kind of a taste you could give us of at least maybe one or two of the things that it has what the research has pointed up so far?
That the comprehensive staffing model has been implemented reasonably effectively at these 8 schools, and then what does that mean? And we sort of try to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will be an interesting report for a lot of reasons, but among others, and we didn't really intend for it to be a primer for parents, but I think it will become one because of this very detailed explanation of how the budget process works and how you, as a parent at your local school, can have an impact.
Well, one of the things that I struck by, I mean, particularly this year, where we had the dynamic of the mayor's education budget, especially relative to DCPS, that was pretty lean, you know, and that for a lot of schools...
That the council built back up.
Yeah, it was going to... if the mayor's budget had stood, it would have represented real cuts for some schools, but the council built it back up. But, you know, the LSATs, and this is the case every year, I mean, they are basically given the mayor's budget, you know, and have to render judgments on what the school would get based on this very early document, you know, where there has been no council weigh in and everything, and that you know, if a school feels like it deserves more, I mean, you know, it takes a lot of effort to go back and sort of try to claw the money back out. And so when the council, you know, found that extra money, you know, there was the expectation that the money would be used to forego the staffing cuts that were going to take place at a lot of these schools. But as it has turned out, much like with the at-risk money that David Catania, that legislation that David Catania had, is that money has just sort of gone into general kitty, and that the DCPS is spending it how it wants, as opposed to, you know, sort of what the intent of the legislative body was, or what the intent of the people who advocated, you know, for the additional money.
And I don't know how that is being handled logistically, if it is increasing the weights or if it is being considered as an additional sum of money. It's what I read tells me that it's just being, as you say, considered to be another pot of money as opposed to being channeled through the uniform student funding formula.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure how they're actually allocating. That's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, like, as an example, at Watkins Elementary School, you know, that's a school that's supposed to get a full-time librarian based on its enrollment, which is over 400.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got that formula. Under 300, you get a half-time. Over 300, you get a full-time. But because of that, you know, the mayor's initial budget, the way that is played out is that the LSAT voted to support the principal's idea of having a half-time librarian and a half-time Spanish teacher. Well, I mean, you know, the expectation was, well, this new money, that it would forego those. But it hasn't played out like that at all. You know, they still have a part-time librarian and a part-time Spanish teacher. You know, and from my perspective, it's like, okay, we've ensured that neither job is going to be done particularly well,
mm-hmm.
you know. And in a lot of schools, as I'm sure you know, there are times when the school will have a good asset, like its library, that the community, that the parents over time have put a lot of effort into maintaining. And, you know, this is an instance where you at least need to have a sense of at least a modest partnership with the school system in terms of, you know, holding up its end, you know. And again, I just think, do you think that there is the possibility of sort of, again, a long-term corrosive effect of lots of people worked really hard to get that extra money for...
But if the council, in increasing the funding, wasn't explicit,
but it was
in budget request act language, then
I think they were. I think they were, though. And I mean, you know, this was the thing in the with the at risk money as well. I mean, you know, this was how they wanted to be spent, and you know, it hasn't been. And you know, as a student, as an observer, as a participant, I mean, maybe you have some sense of why the council is, you know, is unwilling, has proven somewhat squeamish about pushing back about things, you know, where you know, the legislative intent, you know, is not being honored.
Well, I can only tell war stories. I can
yeah.
tell war stories about myself as a council member when we had the control board, which was
yeah.
the all-powerful control board,
yeah.
but the council still had to approve the budget. And in one cycle, I'm probably not remembering this accurately, but in one cycle, I did a line item in the Budget Request Act that had to do with kindergarten aides, because that was something that the control board was not enamored of.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to make sure that money was hardwired. And if you put language in the Budget Request Act that then becomes the appropriation,
mm-hmm.
that then gets congressional enactment,
yeah.
Then it's hardwired. And if you say no less than X can be used for Y, then that money can't be loaded into any other
yeah.
object class than what you're specifying.
Yeah.
And so there are ways to ensure that the money can't be used it doesn't force the money to be used the way you want it to be, but it precludes the money from being used any other way.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I haven't looked at the actual language.
And that it's interesting as it relates to like the modernization as well. Is that, I mean, when DGS came back and asked for that extra $4 million for the Ellington project, one of the things I was struck by with that is, my God, they're actually asking for permission. You know, I feel like in the course of a decade of school modernization, an awful lot of money has moved back and forth, and that it is.
That was an interesting moment, though, on the dais at the council, because in that last legislative session approving that contract, contracts usually come to the council as resolutions, and one of the rules of procedure is you have to vote a resolution up or down, but those were emergency bills, which means they could have been amended, so... You know, if you're a legislator, you can make law. That was a piece of legislation.
Yeah, and it was interesting, though. I think, like, Mary Che said, oh, well, you know, we put in a position if we had to vote up or down, and that wasn't the case, that they could have amended
that. The emergency, the resolution that put the emergency before the council, that's a resolution, but then the underlying bill that they voted on second was an actual, which I it was interesting.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and again, it's like lots of people say, well, $4 million isn't very much money. And I say, well, the United States of America is the only country in the world where you get to say $4 million isn't very much money. But even here, I mean, you know, it's not lunch money. You know, I guess the final question I would ask you would just be about sort of going forward, if this is an issue that you'll examine, or one that you have some thoughts about, is, you know, we have made this enormous investment in the new schools and renovating the old ones and the whole collective enterprise. But do you think that that we're putting the mechanisms in place to ensure that they're properly maintained? That something where we're, what, $700 million in debt service payments, you know, that we're not going to put ourselves in a position because we're not maintaining them effectively.
That's a very good question. And one of the things I remember from some of the construction that was done my last couple of years on the council, we built some rec centers that we then did not maintain.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful rec centers, beautiful pools, but not necessarily maintained well because we didn't put up the operational dollars, not the borrowed money, but the operational dollars to do so. So that is something that we will take a look at some point. I'm not quite sure when, but that we will, because we do have this mandate to look at the school modernization program on an annual basis.
Yeah. One of the things that I've seen, I mean, you know, this probably is a more peripheral manifestation of that, but, you know, that in these modernizations, a lot of schools have gotten very expensive landscaping done, the landscaping plans, the plans. But that, you know, at lots of schools, you know, plants died. There was no mechanism for their care, you know. I mean, Stuart Hobson is a middle school, you know, on Capitol Hill, where I personally am aware that has taken place. And I remember last year, you know, when they had the State of the Schools thing over at Roselle High School, beautiful plantings, but I just remember thinking, I wonder if they're going to be here in a year.
That's an interesting question. And at this point in time, who's in charge of the greenery at a school? Is that DGS or is that DCPS? I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, that is kind of an interesting question. So there are like contracts, but for like lawn mowing. But what often happens is that the lawn mowers just come in and they mow the plants, you know. And so it's just like, but you know, you think, oh, that's in the scheme of these projects, that's nothing. But no, I mean, even though we paid for a design, we paid for the plants.
Right.
You know, it's just sort of like I think there's been so much focus on sort of getting, there's so much that just needs to be get done in the first place,
right.
You know, that's sort of like, well, you know, what happens to this stuff later? No, I don't have time to think about that now, you know, or fund it now.
Right.
But I do wonder, you know, over the long haul, it's like, you know, we borrowed so much. if we don't, and we have to come back and fix the stuff that we didn't maintain properly, will we even have the ability to do so? So, well, Kathy Patterson, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you.